Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, Lebanon and Jordan both share borders with Israel, but have very different relationships with it.
And for many people, what they see is that any kind of delay that happens now in confronting Israel will lead to Israel only attacking them later.
What does direct Iranian involvement mean for Lebanon and Jordan? I'm Malika Bilal, and this is The Take. While Jordan normalized relations with Israel 30 years ago,
after 40 years on the throne, King Hussein had come to make peace.
Lebanon has remained at war.
50 rockets being launched from Lebanon into Israel. You're looking at the latest pictures.
As Iran launched its first direct attack on Israel in the country's history last weekend, in response to an Israeli attack on an Iranian consulate in Damascus, those differences were on full display.
Yes, these are more interceptors that are coming up and that are being intercepted in the skies.
So I talked to someone who's been covering this from several of those countries.
So I'm Nabi Boulos, and I'm the Middle East Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, and I'm based in Beirut since 2012.
So Nabi, welcome to The Take. I want to start with Jordan, where you were just a few days before Iran launched its unprecedented attack on Israel last weekend.
Iran's first direct attack on Israel was full of sound and fury. By Israel's count, 150 ballistic and cruise missiles, bringing the Middle East to the moment of maximum danger, many predicted.
The missiles that it sent had to cross over Jordan in order to reach Israel. And the Jordanian government responded by shooting many of them down.
Officials in Amman insist that Jordan's involvement was a matter of self-defense and protecting its sovereignty, saying that their actions were in fact in line with its own security interests.
Walk me through why they did that and why it made many Jordanians angry.
Well, so the way the government is basically responding to all this is by saying that this was a matter of sovereignty. So, you know, the day after, you actually had the foreign minister on a state TV interview saying that the main purpose, right, of them allowing their airspace to be used by other planes, but also scrambling the Jordan Air Force itself to fight, that was something that was a matter of defending the citizens and basically protecting the sovereignty of the country at all costs, that this was the highest priority.
Our message is clear to everyone, to Israel and to Iran, that we will not allow you to turn Jordan into a war zone, and we will not allow anyone to put the security of our citizens in danger, and we will confront with all our capabilities and according to our resources any party that attempts to violate Jordan's sovereignty and airspace.
And he said something notable, which was that, you know, had these missiles been coming the other way, had they been, you know, Israeli drones and missiles towards Iran, Jordan would behave the same. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue with all this is the following, is that Jordan has actually been rocked by protests for quite some time now. Actually, they've been going on every night since, I think, March 24th. And the reason why is because Jordan has some diplomatic relations with Israel. And what's been happening with these protests is that people are demanding, and this has been a long-standing demand, but of course, it's re-energized now with what's happening in Gaza, that Jordan cut off all relations with Israel and that it stop any kind of economic cooperation. Because it's important to note that most of Jordan's peace framework with Israel is not really political, but mostly really economic, which is to say that it involves water, gas, electricity, and other deals.
Jordan and Israel normalized relations with a treaty in 1994, but it also has an agreement with the U.S. So the U.S. and Jordan have an agreement that sees Jordan get about $1.45 billion a year in economic and military aid, and that's until 2029. What sort of a dilemma does the Jordanian government face here, given its relations with these two nations and the place it finds itself stuck in the middle of?
Well, so Jordan is literally in the middle of all this, which say that geographically, it's the country with the largest border with Israel. And obviously, it's it's on the way from Iran to Israel. If you want to launch missiles, right, you have to go through Jordanian territory. Jordan's issue really is that it also lives and dies to a certain extent at the approval of the U.S., which is to say that it receives a lot of aid. Yes, that's $1.45 billion, but there is other aid as well that, I mean, in many cases, it's the lifeblood of the state. Now, add to that, that Israel also provides Jordan with vital water supplies and electricity, right? This is very, very important for Jordan because water is a perennial issue in the country. It's actually quite parched, and so it needs that water that comes in from Israel at this point. Add to that, that you know, Jordan also has a fairly large Palestinian population, right? And even the Jordanians who are so-called East Bankers, let's say, who are originally from Jordan itself, they feel strongly about it because of simply the milieu they're in. Mm-hmm. And also, it's worth noting that right-wing Israelis always talk about the notion of Jordan being an alternative homeland for the Palestinians. All this is to say that the Palestinian cause is existential for Jordan, both the government and the people. The issue is in the divergence of how people want it to be solved versus the government. I mean, the government is espousing a calm line saying that it has nothing to do with the fight between Iran and Israel, that it wants to stay out of it, and therefore any activity that it did the other day was part of that attitude. Of course, for people who have relatives in Gaza or people who have links to Gaza and are seeing what's happening every day, their feeling is that Jordan is not doing anywhere near enough, that this is simply one more situation where the Jordanian government is acting against people's wishes, which is that they want to basically cut off all relations with Israel, and in fact, perhaps even have a more belligerent attitude in general towards it, and the U.S. for that matter.
So then, what about that segment of the population, that divergence between the people and the government? Does the people's anger represent any kind of threat to Jordan's government? Because I know you've been covering demonstrations in Jordan recently against the war in Gaza. Jordanian police have forcibly removed protesters from outside the Israeli embassy there. So the anger is palpable.
Look, I mean, the fact is that people have been predicting the end of Jordan, or by popular protests or some other way, really since the start of the state, right, since its inception. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think these protests, though they are notable in their persistence and in the fact that they have continued despite the police presence, right, at the same time, people aren't asking for the fall of the regime. And really, Jordanians feel strongly that what's happening right now is actually, it's against the national interest. And they feel that it's important that Jordan take a more belligerent stance. But at the same time, right, they also realize that the idea of having a more intense attitude or a more, let's say, aggressive attitude against the government itself, against the Jordanian government itself, simply will not work.
So that's what's happening in Jordan. But what's likely to happen in southern Lebanon? That's after the break.
The Inside Story podcast dissects, analyzes, and helps define major global stories. We get into the details with experts who explain how policies affect people. The Inside Story podcast by Al Jazeera. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
As Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government promises to respond to Iran's attacks, eyes have been on another one of Israel's neighbors. Israel and armed groups in Lebanon have been trading attacks since October 7th. Our colleagues at AlJazeera.com documented just how heavy those barrages have been. Here's journalist and researcher Jana Daibi explaining her team's findings.
Israel, Hezbollah, and other armed groups in Lebanon exchanged at least 4,733 attacks across the border from October 7, 2023 to March 15, 2024.
They found that Israel has conducted about 83% of those attacks, 3,952 of them. Meanwhile, Hezbollah and other armed groups were responsible for 781 attacks.
The project showed that these attacks broke the traditional rules of engagement between Hezbollah and Israel since 2006 and imposed a new border reality called After October 7. These attacks revealed some of the massive missile capabilities of both sides, Israel holds the most advanced missiles in the Middle East, while Hezbollah is considered to be one of the world's most heavily armed non-states.
Some reports say 50 rockets have been launched from southern Lebanon into northern Israel. Of course, this comes after reports earlier in the day of an Israeli raid into Lebanon, and now we're hearing
in that border area between Lebanon and Israel, there have been attacks on both sides, exchanges of artillery.
Exchanges of fire on the Israel-Lebanon border are escalating. Israel launched an attack deep into Lebanon overnight, killing at least 4 civilians.
So, Nabi, I want to talk about Lebanon because that's where you're based.
Correct.
So, in Lebanon, instead of shooting down missiles aimed at Israel, there are people shooting missiles at Israel. How have Iran's actions affected the ongoing conflict between Iran's ally, Hezbollah, and Israel?
So the notable part here is that it didn't affect it that much. I mean, really, we've had hostilities on the southern border since October 8th. I mean, of course, we've had them, you know, for longer than that. But let's say more active hostilities really started on October 8th. And they have kept up a certain tempo throughout. Yes, there are, let's say, some escalations every now and then. Yes, the number has increased somewhat. But we saw no real appreciable difference in what was happening on Sunday. And the casualty numbers on the side of the Lebanese are, of course, much higher, right? And the damage is much higher. I mean, you have entire villages in the south that are really all but destroyed at this point because of the sheer barrage that is coming from the Israeli side. So that really hasn't changed.
Can you tell me more about what people are facing in Lebanon, especially in southern Lebanon, those cities that have been decimated, people that have left?
Well, you're talking about sort of 90,000 people who have been displaced. So, of course, there's been a large emptying out of a fairly large border area and some of the most beautiful areas you can imagine, by the way, in Lebanon, I might add. But even beyond that, I mean, even beyond the active hostilities that are happening, the fact is the entire south as a region feels quite tense.
We are in the town of Aita, one of the most destroyed towns on the borders between Lebanon and Israel. It's been 6 months that Aita has been pounded with airstrikes, artillery, drones, tanks, whatever. Every day, on daily basis, this town has been hit. And as we can see, it's really a destroyed area.
I'll give you an example. The other day, I went to Beaufort Castle, right? This is a castle that actually, back in the day, had been taken over by the Israelis when they had occupied southern Lebanon. And now it's a bit of a tourist area. And this was really quite far from any, you know, hostile area. Even there, you suddenly saw in the sky this Israeli warplane just streaking past, right, and dropping flares. And at some point, you heard the sonic boom. And this was, I mean, it felt like there was a bombing happening. And so, I mean, the fact is that even beyond what's happening in the southern strip, right, or the very southern border of the country, the feeling of insecurity, the feeling of tension, that really is throughout really almost half of the country. And I mean, the problem is, of course, that people are already hurting from the economic crisis. They're already hurting from so much other stuff that's happening. And now this, it just adds to the misery, really.
What do you think about the possibility that Israel could retaliate against Iran in Lebanon?
Look, it's a possibility. The fact is it would be perhaps, you know, one more way to ramp up the tensions, right? Because, I mean, for example, we've heard time and again from various Israeli military figures that if things were to escalate up to a certain point, that they would then launch an attack on Lebanon that would be many, many multiples of destruction of what happened in the 2006 war, when so much of the infrastructure was destroyed.
The infrastructure shattered, cars blackened by the intense heat, 20-story buildings reduced to piles of concrete and twisted metal. People who had fled Beirut as the bombs began to fall came back to find their homes in ruins.
So the expectation here is that we'll have an equally destructive situation, but over a much larger area of the country. And again, that's just unimaginable.
Does that sort of leave people feeling pretty hopeless and helpless?
Well, It falls within, let's say, a few lines. One of them is if you are a Hezbollah or Iran supporter, right? And whether you are of the supporters of the other side, which basically just wants to live in peace, quote unquote, with Israel, right? Which wants to find some sort of detente where economic prosperity rules over all. So, I mean, that's one end. And then you have the other end, which is basically the have and the have-nots. And Lebanon, you know, like many of these areas, is incredibly unequal.
Lebanon has become, for all intents and purposes, a failed state. Its government is rife with corruption and is unable to care for its people, who suffer chronic and crushing poverty from economic mismanagement and a banking collapse.
You can go to certain areas of Beirut downtown and you'll find people who are just having a great time, bars open, drinking, etc. And then you can go to another area and you find people who are really like rummaging through landfills for about 12 hours a day, right, at the cost of 10 bucks. Where they actually pay for the privilege to go into these landfills, right? And then they take the trash, the plastic, the wood, etc., and they sell it for a pittance, and that's how they make ends meet. The situation is really, you know, really nuts in terms of the divergence you see. And of course, as you can imagine, that just simply compounds the misery that's happening. Yes, there is hopelessness, of course, but at the same time, a lot of people are feeling also very, very angry at what's happening in Gaza, right? It really is an inflection point. And it should be said that Israeli officials haven't given any reassurances of any real change of attitude. They keep on saying that, you know, whether an hour later, they will have to find some way to deal with Hezbollah, which is to say that war is coming no matter what.
Mm, wow. Well, finally, Nibi, I wanted to ask you, it's been said by both politicians and pundits that the Israeli government is using this conflict with Iran and Lebanon to shift the focus of the international community away from what's happening in Gaza and Israel's war on Gaza. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, who we mentioned earlier, said on Tuesday,
"We need to be on the right track to achieve peace in Palestine, Israel, and the whole region. We also need to prevent Netanyahu from diverting attention from what is happening in Gaza."
So that's just one example. In your analysis of this, do you think that's the case?
Look, the fact is it's been said really from everyone, right? Whether it's the Americans or the Jordanians or the European partners or other Arab nations, right? All of them agree on one thing, which is that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has been hoping to use some confrontation with Iran as a way to bring the U.S. into the war in a fuller fashion, but also to distract from what's happening in Gaza. It's fair to say that with this, he has actually to an extent succeeded, because right now we're seeing that the focus is very much on Iran, right, on what Israel will do. I mean, another important fact is that most media organizations seem to have forgotten that the start of this was actually Israel's attack on a sovereign territory in Damascus.
A second major Israeli airstrike on targets in Syria in less than a week. On Monday, missiles hit a section of the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Among the dead pulled from the rubble, a high-ranking Iranian military leader.
And so, I mean, the narrative now has shifted so that it seems that Iran is the irrational actor. When, you know, for people who support Iran, its response was actually quite measured. And so it's important to remember that there is perhaps an ulterior motive here, that by shifting attention to Iran, you both have a free hand in Gaza, but you also increase the chance that the U.S. will go into a conflict with you and help you deal with all of your problems all at once. And of course, it should be said that Netanyahu's case, he also perhaps has a more personal stake in this, and that his government's survival is contingent on this conflict continuing. And so any attempt to basically change that, right, any attempt to calm things down and to give the Israeli people a chance to change their leader is not something that he would want.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by David Enders and Sonia Bagat, with Nagin Oliayi, Sarir Khalili, Khalid Sultan, Amy Walters, Chloe K. Lee, Ashish Malhotra, Berenice Campana, Zaina Bedr, Manahil Navid, Catherine Nguyen, and me, Malika Bilal. Our sound designer is Alex Roldan. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Nay Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back tomorrow.